club football, he pisses all over him. So
yeah. It's just Messi. We all know what Messi can do.
A lot of flair, a lot of skill.
People might forget the names, but the streets certainly won't. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whenever you're listening to this, welcome back to another episode of the FT Lowell podcast and welcome back to another feature session. On this one, we're focusing on Newcastle United and I'm joined by football writer, journalist, scout, pundit, the list goes on. But most importantly for this episode, Newcastle fan, Mr. Christian Hennage. How are you doing, sir?
I'm not too bad, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. As we were saying before, it's the Queen's Jubilee weekend today. So, yeah, for what it's worth, we get a couple of extra days off work. So, can't really complain about that. But you're out across the pond, aren't you? So, I guess it's a normal day for you out there.
Yeah, once I've raised the flag and you know, saluted the national anthem and everything, it's just back to a typical day for me. It's not too crazy.
But that's just what you do every day, is it, anyway?
Yeah. You know what it is. The further you get away from England, the more you love it. That's how it works.
That sounds about right, yeah. Yeah, so, Newcastle. I mean, are you from Newcastle or sort of in and around sort of the Durham area?
Yeah, so I was born in Newcastle and then kind of spent a couple of years in a place called Washington, which is in Sunderland, which probably should have had a greater influence on my allegiances, but my dad was a Newcastle fan, so he kind of drew me to that, and then moved to Durham. But just the way, for anyone that's not familiar with that area, the way that area is kind of constructed or lays itself out is you're like 10, 15 minutes from Durham to Newcastle, 20 minutes to Sunderland. So it's all relatively close anyway. So there's a lot of, I guess you would say, like intermingling of the different fan groups and what have you. I had friends at school who were Sunderland fans, Middlesbrough fans, and you know, all that kind of thing. You grow up all mixed together for the most part.
Yeah. So what was it like growing up? Just generally, was it majority? Is it quite a big majority in Newcastle just because they're, I guess, the biggest team, or in that area was Sunderland still quite big and well supported?
Yeah, well, I'd say because of the age I am, it was just on the cusp of when the Kevin Keegan's Entertainers kicked in. So you're talking, okay, they came up and then they had those title challenges. You've got sort of the Andy Cole period where they come up. And then that transitions to Les Ferdinand, Alan Shearer. And I think that kind of captured the imagination of a lot of youngsters at the time, because they weren't just big in the Northeast. They were big in English football. And I mean, for the most part, that's not to say that Sunderland fans disappeared or anything like that. Because it very much, I think, in England is something you pass down through the family. So I think it was definitely a case of what was the most available for a lot of people that got them into that stuff. But I think things like the Derby and stuff like that kind of brought everyone together, in the sense that being Durham, because it's neither Newcastle nor Sunderland, it's sometimes I've seen it described as like a battleground for fandom, like it's where they try and grab fans for the respective clubs. But yeah, I'd say in my experience, just growing up in Durham, it lent definitely more towards Newcastle, because I think they were a bit easier to access and a bit easier to get to.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I mean, definitely down south as well, like Newcastle are very well supported down there, you know, relatively for a kind of northern club. I know quite a few London-based Newcastle fans, whereas, yeah, I guess the likes of Sunderland and Middlesbrough, I don't think I've ever met one sort of south of Birmingham, shall we say. But I guess the question I did have is, Newcastle is, you know, obviously seen as one of the best supported clubs in England, definitely in the top four or five. In America, what's it like? Because they obviously had that goal film. Did that get people's attention? Or
it's funny. I forget who I was talking to about with this, but the goal film absolutely did boost the numbers. It's not to say that, you know, they're this global football club because of it. No, not at all. But even I think a couple of weeks ago, there was, I want to say it was in the Canadian Premier League, one of the clubs did a TikTok where they said, what's the best football film ever? And it was as their players were leaving to go to the changing room. So if you ask them a question, they tell you their answers, they leave the pitch. And there was a number of them said goal. And I think because it was just kind of this sweet spot, because A, it was Newcastle, but then B, it was the fact it was the lead was a young Mexican lad coming over, living in America. Like, it just brought the two together quite nicely. And so I think it gave it that cachet. Now, obviously, that's changing quite rapidly now because the club have been taken over. There's these huge aspirations. There's all this kind of thing. So those cultural touch points that existed are now starting to be illuminated again, things like goal. So I wouldn't say no. If I went to probably the biggest football bar in New York here maybe 12 months ago, no, I wouldn't say it would be littered with Newcastle fans. It really isn't. It's very much dominated by the top six, the what you would constitute the bigger clubs. But I would say there is definitely an awareness of Newcastle and their background and their history, even if it doesn't stretch to sort of what I would consider like the golden years in the modern era, as kind of oxymoronic as that sounds.
Yeah, I guess where you are as well, Man City bigger there than in other parts of the country just because of the connection to New York City or not?
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely been a sort of crossover with the two clubs in terms of fandom and things like that, and people picking up one and then picking up the other as sort of, because that's something I have to be honest, I hadn't really come across that much when I was at home, this idea of like a second club or a club you support in Europe and a club you support in North America. Is for me, it's very much been like I've only got the frustration for one team, but I've only got, you know, the appreciation for one team. But I think that is certainly changing. And yeah, you know, it's difficult in the sense of, I look at some of the American sports here when I've kind of tried to get into them. I think for the most part, when you get into them, it's very hard to convince yourself that it's a good idea to pick a very bad team. You want to be entertained a little bit. That's what probably drew you to the sport at first. So it's no great shock to me that let's say newer fans gravitate to those teams towards the top.
Yeah. And would you say it's growing out there? I think it's the next World Cup's going to be USA, mm-hmm. Mexico, isn't it? And it's Canada in it.
It's 2026, yeah. Which, I mean, that's the funny thing. I mean, I do get asked that fairly often in terms of, it is the sport growing out here? In a weird way, I think it's already very well established. It just kind of depends where you look. I think whether it would ever be as ubiquitous as it is back home, where it dominates everything, or, you know, in Spain, where you have dedicated sport papers and all this, like, I think it's just the way the culture manifests it is slightly different. Because, you know, I can go to past the school at the top of my street, and pretty much every night there'll be 8 to 10 lads kicking a ball around. I think it's just whether you see it front and center on like a Good Morning America or something like that's different. I think the appetite for it is absolutely here. You can see it, I think, really easily when teams from Mexico play in the US, be it here in New York or somewhere else. The tickets go really quickly and the atmospheres are brilliant. We at NYCFC, we played a Mexican team last year, Pumas, and the atmosphere was brilliant because, you know, the fans are dotted around everywhere. And I think ultimately that will probably help soccer in this country as we move forward, is as the generations start to establish and people move around and say, you know, a kid whose dad is from New York moves to Wyoming, he will, you would imagine, raise him to be an NYCFC fan because he was. Yeah. And then if they go to play in Wyoming, it's not an MLS team there yet, but you never know, you would like to think he will try and get a ticket for the away end. So it's just a case of that slow build, which I think it can seem like it's never coming, but I think I've seen enough green shoots here while I've been here to say that it is.
Okay. Yeah, they show all the games, don't they, as well out there. So I guess you've got no problem sort of catching Newcastle every week, other than, I suppose, time zones can make those early ones a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I'll level with you now. I've definitely slept through some lunchtime kickoffs. Under Steve Bruce, there was definitely a couple where I thought, I'm not getting up at 7 in the morning for that. I'll catch the second half. But yeah, I think that is an odd quirk as well, that, you know, I, however thousands of miles away, can watch the 3 o'clock kickoffs or all of the Newcastle games easier than my brother, who is, you know, 20 mile away. It's odd to me. I don't fully get it. I will say this. I'm very glad that I live here now as opposed to even, let's say, 10, probably 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, because then it definitely felt like you were planets away. And it felt like you might, if you were lucky, maybe get one game a month or what have you, or, you know, trying to watch it on less than great internet. Like, I think the American football fan is very blessed in the sense that they are given more exposure to the Premier League and now Serie A, La Liga, than ever before. And so they get a much greater grasp, I think, of not just what it means, but what it's like. And I think that's why you see a good portion wanting to go over and actually take games in, because the way it's presented here is like brilliant in terms of enticing you over to come and watch it.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, if you want to watch the English Premier League, move to the States.
Yeah, honestly, if you can't afford a season ticket, just move to America. It's a lot easier.
Yeah. Did you ever have a season ticket then when you were sort of growing up?
Unfortunately, I didn't, because as I'm now seeing now, my brother does have a season ticket. He actually got one last summer, which I still can't believe. But the return of waiting lists and things like that harks back to when I was a kid, when it was really, really difficult to get tickets. And if you could, you were up on the top deck. I don't know, have you ever been to St. James's Park yourself?
I've never been, but I know about being up there in the gods, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
More than any other ground, isn't it, that one?
It's oxygen tank territory for sure. So when I was younger, you could really, for the most part, only get tickets up there. And even then, it was difficult. I think it was probably easier around the championship season under Chris Hughton. I went to quite a few of those games. And then obviously, by the time that they came back up, I had started working. So for the most part, I was covering games. So a season ticket didn't make sense. But no, it's not something I've ever had. But I think if I was to move back tomorrow, I would do pretty much everything I can to try and get one, because I think it is a great experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's going to be many people giving up their season tickets at the moment. we've watched potentially to come, but yeah, it's very exciting times for Newcastle. And I'm an Arsenal fan, but I suppose I'd say I've got a bit of a soft spot for Newcastle. Sort of growing up, they were one of the sort of big sides, but not necessarily seen as like a big rival, one that you hated and stuff, I guess, because of where they was in the country kind of thing. But yeah, we had some really good games against you really throughout the early noughties and stuff. So yeah, it's good to see, well, we don't know for sure, but like the way that it's projecting to go.
It's good to see hope back, I think. Is the way I would characterise it. That was, funnily enough, against Arsenal just at the end of the season there. That is what I felt like I saw. Like, you know, the football, if you were to write the two teams on paper, you're a much better team than we are. I don't think there's any argument in that. But I think what I saw on that night, it wasn't really a spectacle of football from our side. It was just a lot of positivity. I think that's what I saw, just boundless positivity. And I've had many debates with mates about that, in terms of, like, you know, should we ever like really boo our own players? Like, does that ever really achieve like anything in the grand scheme of things? But I think when you get that, when you like break the seal of just everyone's in the same direction, everyone's happy, it can pull the divisions together. It really can. Yeah. It can have non-league feel like Champions League in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, and I think Newcastle has been one of those crowds that even when they were in the Championship. I know you said it was easier to get tickets and stuff, but they were still pulling ridiculous crowds for that sort of level. And yeah, if you get 50 odd thousand on side, then yeah, it can make a hell of a difference for sure. Yeah, but if we get into your team then, so, well, first off, what formation have you gone for?
So I've gone for a sort of 4-4-2, where I guess one of the forwards will be hanging a tiny bit deeper.
Okay, fair enough. So in goal, who's between the sticks?
So this, you know, I thought this would be really easy. And then I actually started to think about it. And at first there was some recency bias with Martin Dubravka because he's been so sort of consistent and all that kind of stuff. But the more I thought about it, I couldn't overlook Shea Given. Given was not perfect. He was kind of glued to his line a little bit and he was a little bit susceptible to being beaten from distance. But some of the saves he pulled off, there's one against Kevin Phillips in the derby, where the way he kind of arches his body, because he's not, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen him up close. He's not a massive goalkeeper, Shea Given. I think he's only 6'1", or barely even that. It might be 5'11".
I think he was maybe on the cusp of 6 foot or below, yeah.
Which, again, it almost makes it more impressive. But yeah, I think for him, for his consistency, for his longevity, kind of, in a weird way, I was trying to explain to someone here the other day what the canary down the mine means.
And I've never heard that phrase before.
So it basically, to digress slightly, miners used to take a canary down with them, and if the canary ever collapsed or died, it told them that there was gas in the where they were and they needed to get out. And so for me, in a weird way, Shea Given was kind of the canary down the mine, because when he left to go to Man City, I knew we were in real trouble, because I was like, well, he clearly doesn't think this is going anywhere up. He thinks somewhere else is better. So, yeah, I think Shea Given is the man between the sticks for me, for sure.
Yeah, he was definitely one of my favourite goalies growing up. Yeah, because he was a bit shorter as well. Some of the saves that he did make probably did just look that a little bit better as well. Like, maybe if you had like a 6'6" goalkeeper making that save, it might not look as good, but because of his size, it just made it look even better. And yeah, what a player for Ireland as well. Got a couple of World Cups or Euros and World Cup under his belt and stuff. So yeah, that's a top shout. And yeah, I think that it's probably not the easiest choice, but it's probably one of the more nailed I thought you might have gone for before sort of seeing your team. So right back is
100% probably recency bias, because actually when I thought about the right backs that I grew up with, because I had Warren Barnes to start with, you know, and you had like Aaron Hughes, you had a little bit further forward Matty Debussy, people like that, there was never really anyone that kind of grabbed me. But Kieran Trippier has just, like, everything about that lad since he's come in has been top class. Yeah, he's just, I know that's a bold shout. I'm well aware that there'll be Newcastle fans asking me if I just started following them in January. But I think, I don't know if you can relate to this at all, because as an Arsenal fan, you're kind of used to high quality players. But have you ever had that moment where someone's just come into the team and they're just levels above everyone around them?
I suppose with Cesc, yeah. Fabregas.
Okay, so that's kind of how I felt with Kieran Trippier, because, you know, he is a little bit on the older side now, so he's not lightning quick, but just everything he does makes the team better. So whether he's on the ball, I mean, his free kicks alone have probably, no probably about it really, played a massive part in keeping us up this year against Villa and Everton. His quality on the ball, but then just his leadership from kind of start to finish, whether he was on the pitch, you know, helping organise, whether he was on the sideline warming up, just giving the lads bits of instruction. Even when he was injured, he was wanting to travel to the games just to be around things and be helpful. And I think if there's a player that's probably going to be pretty influential, touch wood, he stays injury free for these next couple of years, I think it's going to be him, because he's just used to a level. And I think it's no slight on the players around him. They've all come in and done what they needed to do. And, you know, they're all very good professionals. I think sometimes actually we kind of forget that like even a player that maybe only manages a season in the Premier League is a very good footballer. Like if they came down goals on a Wednesday night, they would run rings around all of us, because they're just, there's a certain level to it. But I think he's just come in and understood what was needed and given it. And I think he's raised everyone just up. Everyone's sitting up straight, I feel like, when he's around. So yeah, I think as bold as that might be, I think I have to put him in there just because of his quality.
Yeah, that's a big shout. But yeah, he hasn't put a foot wrong since he's come, and I can't believe he got him in January. I was shocked. I know that, you know, the project and stuff, but he's given up a lot to sort of come in at this time. In the summer, I thought maybe it would have made a bit more sense. But yeah, he seems to be absolutely loving it. Like, I know you probably got to take a few of the training videos and things with a pinch of salt, but you can kind of tell from that the influence that he's got on some of the guys in the team, and yeah, his leadership and stuff, like you said.
I mean, don't get me wrong, if I was 16, I'd have been writing on a football message board, of course he's joined us because we're massive. Because I was very much like, I don't know if you remember, Arsene Wenger said something to the effect of, like, everyone thinks like they have the most beautiful wife in the world when it comes to their football club. Like, I was the same as a kid. I thought my club was the best thing ever. Like, why wouldn't you want to come here? All that kind of stuff. I think it was just a perfect storm. He wanted to come home. But even just as a first signing for like, the owners, for Eddie Howe, you're absolutely right. Perfect storm. Like, I think if anything surprised me about the last 6 months, it's just how we've managed to hit the right beat every time, because it could have gone so poorly. I mean, I was at the game, funnily enough, at Christmas against Man United when Callum Wilson does his calf in and he's out for 3 months. So Maximin looks like done for. And we get a draw in a game. I think we should have won. And you're thinking, how are we going to turn this around? And then he comes in and you start to think, okay, that's a good start. But yeah, I think it's such a massive stroke of fortune to have managed to get him in.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, all the players you have signed in January, they've not come for the money, really, have they? They're not signing, I guess, like Man City did with Robinho, big, big names like that. They're signing good players. Even now, I think they're looking a lot in the French market by the looks of it, and going for sort of those younger under 25s generally. So I think they're definitely going about it the right way. But yeah, Trippier in a relegation battle, that's the sort of experience that you probably need to just get over the line that first year and then grow from there in the other areas. So yeah, big shout. Very surprised at that, but to be fair, yeah. I can't think of any particular other Newcastle right backs that were amazing, as you say. So yeah, fair enough. Yeah, do you want to go left back or one of your centre backs?
Yeah, so left back, again, I kind of thought, like, how many great fullbacks have we really had? I mean, we've had some that seem great on paper, like Danny Rose came with a tremendous pedigree. Could argue a bit like Trippier, actually, and just was okay. Like, wasn't really, you know, one way or the other. So I've gone for Jose Enrique, because as tempting as it was to go for someone like John Beresford, who was, like, you know, rampaging, I just felt like I saw such consistency from Enrique. He a bit like another player I'll talk about in a bit, went into the Championship, and I think it made kind of him in England. I think it really helped him get used to things, understand how we play in England. And he came up, I mean, he was brilliant in the Championship, but then he just came up and didn't stop. He was comfortable on the ball. He could get himself out of danger, even though he was a little bit one-footed. He could attack, he could defend, and there was no surprise in my mind that Liverpool wanted him in the end, because I thought, yeah, he's a very high quality fullback. That you might say now maybe he benefited slightly from the fact that in Jonas Gutierrez he had an incredibly hard working winger in front of him, which kind of helped him a little bit. But yeah, the standout memory I have of Jose Enrique was it was my last year of uni and we were in the Championship and we needed to beat Nottingham Forest to go up, who obviously now are back in the Premier League, crazy of all things. And he got the second goal. And I remember I fell down the seats because I was just that pleased to be out of the Championship. Like, didn't know what that season was going to bring, and we were done and we were back in the Premier League. And in theory, we'd never come back here again. We'd learn all our lessons, which was totally wrong. But it was just like a wonderful way to like finish off a season pretty much, or at least get the job done, because we had a few games to play before that, or after that rather. But yeah, he was just a very strong, reliable, good fullback, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't have minded him at Arsenal actually, around that time, around sort of 2011, 2012, when he did eventually move on to Liverpool. I thought it was pretty solid, but I definitely think you got the best of him at Newcastle. Even though, if you've seen his sort of Twitter and things like that, you'd have no idea he played for Newcastle. Because all he bangs on about is Liverpool. He's like their number one fan by the looks of it.
He reminds me a little bit of lads I used to go out with who would get like one nice piece of clothing, like one pair of really good trainers. And it didn't matter how many times you went out, they always wore the same ones, as if like, oh, I've just pulled this out. It's like, we get it, Jose. Like, you played a couple of games for Liverpool. It was decent. But no, I mean, look, he left us under a little bit of a cloud, dare I say, because he basically decided, like, you know, I think I've done all I can here. And I think maybe it was the way he phrased it or what have you. But he basically said, like, this team won't challenge for the top six. Like, as long as, you know, I think he said Mike Ashley's here. And it just, I think he got a bit misconstrued. But, you know, I think now that Ashley's gone and all that kind of stuff, a lot of things have been forgiven. And yeah, I don't know why it didn't work for him at Liverpool, if I'm honest. Because, yeah, I thought he would have been all right. But in the end, yeah, a very good fullback, I think, on his day.
Yeah, definitely. And your centre-backs?
Yeah, now these are definitely different eras, these two. Fabrizio Colaccini is the first one. Now, he was the one I was referencing before with Jose Enrique, because he came here and I think he didn't quite adjust. I mean, look, it was an awful time in terms of the team he joined and all that kind of stuff to just throw him in and expect him to come good instantly. But I think that season of the Championship really helped him get settled, and he came up and he was just brilliant. I mean, some fans I know will argue he stayed a little bit too long. His career sort of tailed off before he left us and went back to Argentina. But in his peak, the year we finished fifth, the year he was in the team of the season, I remember I covered a Sunderland-Newcastle game and they went down to 10 men inside the first half when Cheick Tiote got sent off. And I can't think of a more influential defensive performance I've been there for in person than his, because the second he went off, I think they conceded like a couple of minutes later, because he was just everywhere. And it wasn't even just the fact that he could head it and kick it and tackle it. It was just how he read the game, how good he was on the ball, how he could get himself out of trouble. There's a case to be made he probably should have played for a better team than us at that time in terms of quality. But he was what I would consider like the definition of a Rolls-Royce defender in terms of his quality and his intelligence. And funnily enough, I think the reason I appreciate him is because of the other guy that I've picked. Because the other guy I've picked is Philippe Albert.
Okay.
Who, again, you could pretty much take all of the compliments I've just given Colaccini and apply them to Philippe Albert, because he was someone that played like he was a central midfielder that had just dropped back for 5 minutes. Like,
yeah,
it was,
yeah.
I mean, everyone understandably thinks of the goal against Man United, and you know, that is understandable. It's possibly one of my favourite Newcastle goals ever, just because of, not even just what he did, but the context of it as well. You know, I imagine if you went and were winning 4-0 against Spurs, and then Gabriel did that for the fifth, it's like the perfect way just to end the day. But you look at a few of the goals he scored, I don't think he ever really scored a tap-in. I think they were all kind of high quality goals that used his technique. And I just think when you are younger, what you were exposed to first, I think kind of influences how you enjoy football. And I think seeing a defender who wanted to play that way, who didn't want to just kick it long, who wanted to try and build things out, that absolutely was something I always grew up appreciating. And so when someone like Colaccini came into the team, you were like, oh, this kind of resonates with me. This harps back to what I grew up with. So yeah, those two, if you're wanting to play modern football as we see it now, those two will do it all day long and have no problems with it, I reckon.
Yeah. I hope you've got a defensive player in front of them now. Just in case. They both wandering off at the same time. But that would definitely be entertaining. I think that, yeah, Colaccini could have definitely been in that Kevin Keegan entertainer side as well, couldn't he? Yeah, the Albert goal against Man United. Although people say because it was against Schmeichel, that was his weakness, getting lobbed.
Yeah,
there's a lot of clips, but no, yeah, that goal was unbelievable for a defender to be able to do that. Yeah, insane, really. So 4-4-2, yeah, you've got, or yeah, sort of maybe 1-1, yeah. So okay, where do you want to start here?
So on the right wing, I have Norberto Solano. There were a few, I mean, look, it's probably harder for me with the left wing because we've had a number of really good left wingers, but I think something with Solano was, yeah, you could argue he was very one-footed, but the way he played, it wasn't an issue. In terms of, you know, he would use the outside of his right foot like it was his left foot. And just his quality and all this stuff, and I think with certain players, you only really kind of appreciate them a little bit when you get older and you realise what they were doing at the time, because you almost take it for granted a bit, like, oh, he's crossed it onto Shearer's head again. Great, this is,
yeah,
you know, he's done that a few times this year. But I think his technical brilliance, I feel like, God rest his soul, Maradona talked him up quite well as well, Solano, because he was at Boca Juniors with him for a bit. But yeah, his technical ability, his ability to cross, danger from set pieces, the fact he played a trumpet, there was really everything there with Solano.
there was a
nice wide range of stuff to appreciate with him. And the first Sunday team I ever played for, when we actually got proper numbers and everything, I remember getting the number 4 and instantly thinking, right, who's the number 4 for Newcastle? That's what I have to play like. And it was Solano. So there's always been like a small appreciation for him and everything. And he was, funnily enough, I missed him, unfortunately, but he was at our training ground, I think it was maybe last year, to see a Peruvian centre-back we have. And I can't say how devastated I was that I wasn't there that day, just to kind of see him and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, a wonderful footballer on his day, Nobby Solano.
He was one of these players that I think went under the radar for me on his end product. Like, I knew he was very good technically and, yeah, could kind of play any sort of pass with his right foot, as you say. But I think he's got one of the most assists in Premier League history as well. I think he's fairly high on that list.
Incredibly creative. And I actually think, you know, with wingers, it's a bit tough because I guess maybe the wingers I grew up with and maybe you grew up with, as they started to lose a bit of their speed, that you tended to find they kind of dipped a bit. But I felt like actually as he got older, his understanding, his intelligence really came to the fore. I remember he scored against Arsenal, I think, if I remember right, at St James's once. But the goal that always sticks out to me is one against Everton where it's kind of narrow, really. He's almost just inside the box. And he just takes one touch with his right and then just opens the outside of his foot and just bends it round the goalkeeper. And I just think, you know, as kids growing up watching that, how blessed, like, we don't choose when we're born. You know, we don't choose what football we grow up with. But things like that, that's technical brilliance, whether it happens now or in 20 years' time. You can't really argue with it.
Yeah, didn't he play centrally as well? Like, at Villa, was it, when he went there, or was it still on the right wing?
Yeah. That's a good question. Actually, I'm not sure. I think he had spells at right back. I think he sort of.
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah.
You know, as someone who himself is closer to retirement than the start of his playing career, you do tend to go backwards a little bit the older you get, as you want more of the pitch in front of you.
Yeah, we've done a couple of collabs with a podcast, Victory and Vices, and they interviewed Nobby Solano, and I think he did get his guitar out and did a little song on that as well. And then, yeah, they said he was, yeah, absolute pleasure to talk to him. Have you ever met him then, or was that the opportunity?
I haven't. That's as close. Funny enough, I tell that, I've come closer than that. So many years ago, my dad met him in a petrol station, and then I was at the Copa America when it was here in New York, and he was on the coaching staff of Peru. And I can't remember if they'd won or lost, but I was in the mix zone, and I said to him, like, just as he was walking past, I was like, Nobby, and just, God bless him, he was clearly in a rush and he just didn't have the time. So, no, I'm hopeful, fingers crossed, if he has to come back, that I get something of a warning so I can get up there and just tell him how much I appreciate him, I guess.
Yeah, nice. All right, so do you want to tackle the left mid dilemma, or are you saying that one?
Yeah, let's go for the tough one next, I think, because the funny thing is the players that all jumped into my head are all French. I think Alan Saint-Maximin hasn't done enough yet. I think he's exciting, but he hasn't done enough. So then you get down to the other three sort of French players, which is David Ginola, who again was, you know, looked like a model and was just, the athleticism of the man was outrageous. When you consider how powerful he was and how he drove with the ball. Then there's Laurent Robert, who, you know, could just, the shot on him could, oh, you know.
Some of the goals he scored is ridiculous.
Yeah, just I remember the only time I can ever really remember us doing fairly well against Arsenal, funnily enough, at Highbury, he was pretty central to that. And I will 100% show my age, because it was a midweek game and you had to follow it on teletext. That's how long ago that game was.
A bit of teletext, yeah.
Yeah, waiting for the page to refresh. But yeah, so there's him. And then the third one is Hatem Ben Arfa. Now, the problem I have with Hatem Ben Arfa is I don't know if I've seen many better technical footballers in person than him, in terms of his speed, the way he could change direction. The greatest compliment I can possibly pay him is, I used to try, when I was covering Newcastle, see if I could guess which way he was going to go when he would square a defender up. I never once got it right, genuinely. Never once got it right. And all the time I was watching him. And it was something whereby you would see him and you know, he would get closer and closer. And it would almost look like he was jogging and they were sprinting. And you see the level he's played at, you know, PSG and Lyon and all this kind of thing, and for the French national team, and you think, he will be possibly one of the more frustrating football stories ever. As much as he has achieved, you feel like he could have achieved so much more. Yeah. And so in reality, it was kind of like an oscillating three between, just on a typical Saturday, who would I want? Ben Arfa could be a pain as well. And I've spoken to enough people that worked with him or alongside him to know he could be a pain. So I'm leaning towards Laurent Robert, just because of the consistency I felt like he gave. Look, he didn't want to defend. Jose Enrique is in for a long Saturday afternoon. he's not getting past the halfway line, is poor Jose. But I think Laurent Robert's quality, his ability from distance, he's just got a bit of everything. And then to top it all off, one of his last goals, that scorpion kick against Fulham. Just supreme technical quality. Just, again, quite one-footed, actually, when you think about it. Probably, you would argue Ben Arfa and Ginola might be better technically in terms of dribbling and stuff like that. But yeah, he was just another blessing of a footballer to watch.
Going back to goal, I'm pretty sure at least one of the goals was based on a Laurent Robert free kick as well.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. It was against Liverpool.
Yeah, a free kick he
curled over Scott Carson. But like that, in a lot of ways, that was like very typical of him. Like his free kicks were, it's James Ward-Prowse is kind of the de facto great free kick taker these days.
Yeah.
And I think Alan Shearer was asked to rate them for match of the day or something like that, like his best free kick takers. And yeah. I felt like it was a scandal that Robert wasn't in there because, you know, I feel early days against Man United, he scored a great free kick. I think he hit one at Anfield that was a free kick from distance that was ridiculous. Like the power and technique involved just in his shooting alone was ridiculous. When you think, I know it's not as large a jump, but what footballs were like then compared to what they're like now in terms of movement, when you hear like Ben Foster talk about it, I can't even imagine what his free kicks would be like these days if he was stepping up to take them.
Yeah, I'm not 100% if he's the best free kick taker in the Prem, but definitely he's 100% the one I'd least want to be in the wall for. he would take anyone out, even his own players. I mean, I guess that's why you have to put Jose Enrique in there anyway, because you can't have Olivier Panard in there because. Yeah.
Well, that's the funny thing. You mentioned Bernard. I wasn't sure if that's what you were referencing. That there, I don't want to say famous because I know Olivier quite well, or somewhat well because we've done some work together. That was the player that when trying to clear the ball, he clocked upside the head and sent quite dizzy was Laurent Robert. So yeah, I've tried to find some balance in there the best I can.
Yeah, I've really rated Robert. I think there's a couple of goals he got against Tottenham as well. From memory, which were both, I think they were both like 30 odd yard volleys or something in the same game, which I think Suarez might have done something sort of similar, but that's the only other time I've seen that happen a couple of times in the game. So yeah, great player. And yeah, a lot of French, there's quite a lot of South Americans as well in kind of Newcastle's history or last 25, 30, since Aspria came, I guess, there's been quite a few.
It's on the upturn again. You've got Bruno and Joe Linton leading the pack there. You've got Miguel Almiron as well. I'm not sure why that is, to be honest. I don't know. Maybe there's something resonates there. Maybe it's just fortune, you know. You probably saw that a little bit with Arsenal. I feel like there was quite a strong French influence there at one point, but that's probably because of Arsene Wenger. So, It's funny how those kind of legacies and myths kind of build, or mythoses build as time goes on. I mean, I have to confess, Bruno was definitely in the running for central midfielder because, you know, look, I appreciate the same with Trippier. He's only been here 6 months, but you can just see his quality every time he touches the ball. It just shines through. He is every bit a £40 million player and probably more if I'm really honest. But in terms of the central midfielders, This one might get me a couple of slaps around the head in Newcastle, I'm not sure. I did not go for Rob Lee, who I know is like very well considered. I went for Johan Cabaye as the first one because I think in the line of Bruno, me in general, like, you know, I've got no affiliation to Man United. I love Michael Carrick because any player that maybe is smarter with the ball in terms of just passing it around over running around, I appreciate, because to be honest, that was the kind of player I was and am. I'm not the most athletic, so it's always been about what I could do with the ball at my feet. And I think Cabaye was that type of player. He was someone that wanted to control things, wanted to dictate tempo and that kind of thing. And his quality, pretty much from the moment he came in, it was very clear that for £5 million, again, a bit like Bruno, we had done an outrageous deal. Yeah, because that period in sort of Newcastle history was a bit of a funny one because the team that had got us up was very industrious. It was like very like British based. It was Kevin Nolan, Joey Barton, Steve Harper. There was a lot of guys that would not shirk responsibility, which at the time was 100% what we needed. And even the year we came up, Kevin Nolan, I think, got 11 goals that year. So was more than comfortable probably for another season or two. But that was never going to be the Mike Ashley way. And as soon as he realised that we could essentially, for like £1 million more, I think we sold him for £4 million to West Ham and then bought Cabaye for £5 million because of a contract clause. And he had just won Ligue 1 with Lille as well. It just made complete sense. And you as soon as you saw him, you saw quality in his first goal against Wigan. Beautiful shot from the edge of the box. And ever since then, when he was on song, especially I would say towards the end of his time, again in that Jose Enrique bracket of, you know, was said to have refused to play because he wanted, because we wouldn't do a deal with Arsenal of all people. That soured a lot of people onto him, and I get that. But then I think he was sold the idea of this would always be a stepping stone. And I think his quality, especially towards the end, when I think he knew the move was coming, he was just unplayable in parts. It was a game at West Ham where he just took the game and just decided when he was going to win it. Really, you know, those kind of players and that kind of performance where it's up to them when it ends. It's you can dance around it for as long as you want. He was that kind of player at that point. And yeah, just a player I really enjoyed watching. Just someone that I thought, yeah, if I could play even half as good as him, I'd be so happy with life.
That's another one. There's quite a few in that team, that era, that was linked with Arsenal that I would have been pretty happy if we had gotten. Kabar's definitely in that bracket. I think we wanted to play him. If we were going to sign him, we would have played him further back. Playing at Newcastle, but I think he would have definitely had the intelligence to do that job as well. I'm thinking of maybe it was the goal against Wigan, but there is definitely a goal that sticks in my mind, which was like a free kick from the edge of the box. Maybe it was that one, but I think it was in your season where you were finishing fifth in the league.
I'm trying to think. Oh, there was the one against Man United in January.
It might have been that one.
That was the night we beat them 3-0. I mean, if there was a knock on him, you would say that he wasn't maybe athletic enough to really get around the pitch all the time. I think that was probably the one slight on him, was that, you know, if you're wanting him to play deeper, can he get across all the time? Probably not. But then that's where I think I kind of hit a bit of a funny patch, because as soon as I put Kabai in the list, I thought, well, Tioti has to go next to him, because the two of them, I don't know if I've seen a better partnership sort of just in tandem like that, in terms of Kabai knew what Kabai was good at, Tioti knew what Tioti was good at, and they just dovetailed perfectly in terms of Tioti, you know, you probably all heard that shout on a Sunday morning, like, keep it simple. When Tioti kept it simple, he was undeniably one of the best midfielders, I think, that I've seen in a Newcastle shirt, because his strength, his tenacity, his ability to just read situations. I think where he went a bit wrong was, I think he started to believe the hype that he was going to be the next Essien, because I think someone on Sky had said it, which, look, I liked Tioti a lot. I liked Michael Essien a lot. There's no comparison between those two in terms of what they do or how they play. I think it was like a really bad idea. And yes, so I think as controversial as it might be, I think I would put Tioti there alongside Kabai, just as, because you said I need that defensive midfielder, and you're like, yeah, not wrong, I do. I need a bit of a shield for Colaccini and Albert. So I think Tioti nestles in there nicely.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot, to be honest. It's got a nice balance to it, for sure. And like, they've played together, so you know it's going to work as well. So, yeah, I can't knock that at all, really.
And do we want to talk about Tioti's goal? I genuinely was watching it just the other day, would you believe?
I had a bet on Arsenal that game, and I never bet on Arsenal, really, for or against. Like, I don't really look to do that, but I think maybe that's the last time I did it, actually. And I was like, okay, well, fine, easy then. And then,
I don't blame you.
I didn't know he was capable of doing that, to be honest.
We didn't either, to be honest. it was funny. There was a lad I was at uni with at the time. Him and his mate, they left at half time.
I think quite a lot of people did, didn't they?
Yeah, it was. There was a decent number of grey seats on show in the second half, for sure. And they actually made it into the paper as so it was quite cruel. It was like these two guys who were depressed because they left at half time. But no, they put the full game on the YouTube channel during lockdown. And it happened to be on autoplay the day, and I was like, I'm just going to sit and watch this for a bit and just kind of, you know, just see what it was like and all that kind of stuff. And young Jack Wilshere tearing about, and I'm like, ah, he was a good player, wasn't he? And you see that moment, and yeah, that team, that period, it was a lot more hard work than quality, which I think if you've got one, you can kind of forgive the other a little bit. But yeah, that goal in particular definitely started a period of fans shouting shoot anytime he got within about 25 yards, because there's that belief of, oh well, he can definitely do that again. There was no chance. It was because, again, I imagine you're the same. We've all hit one that we're like, bloody hell, that was good, you know, you just catch it like sweet. And you try and play it off and you try and make it seem like, yeah, I was doing them the other week in the back garden, it's no big deal. But yeah, it was a memorable. Terribly sad that he's no longer with us, obviously, as well, which is another just surreal thing. I still think now doesn't really kind of like sink in that he's just, watching it back, I was like, I couldn't believe that he's just not here anymore. But yeah, I think as sort of legacies go, I couldn't find anyone with a bad word to say about him as a person and as a teammate. And I think he actually, that season when he came in, was the same year that Ben Arfa came in, and unfortunately Ben Arfa broke his leg quite early into his time on loan. But I remember Tiote came in, and I want to say, was Everton away his first game? It might have been his first game, and just instantly, the way he kind of just put his foot on the ball and just passed it around and kept it calm and just settled things down, it was so clear to everyone the quality, not even just the quality that he had, but the influence that would have on us. And so, yeah, just a great player, a great guy, and I think someone that will give us some balance in this team for sure.
Yeah, that's a top shot. And yeah, I can imagine that no one would have a bad word to say about him, because, yeah, he did seem like one of them lovable characters that, yeah, your teammates would want to play with, really. So, yeah, nice. So you're two up front, but what have you got? Is it sort of like a number 10 kind of thing?
Well, the idea is that the guy who's playing up top is probably going to be working on flick-ons a little bit. But I also think, even in a traditional two, like, let's say, Burnley, there's always one that comes a little bit deeper. So it's more about that. And the guy who's playing that first role is probably going to drop a bit deeper. It was tough because I looked first at Peter Beardsley, who was probably, I would say, just before my time, like just before my time. But you watch the videos of what he could do with a football. And I've seen people that played with him. I think Steve Howie was the last one who said, look, if you're trying to find as close as you can to someone like Messi, small, low centre of gravity, like ball looks like it's glued to his foot, Peter Beardsley is who you're looking for. And I appreciate, you know, that sounds crazy of someone that didn't achieve probably half of what Messi did in his career, but his intelligence, his technical brilliance, just right up there. But for me, the player that kind of really first grabbed my attention was Les Ferdinand.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sir Les Ferdinand.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Sir Les Ferdinand. Because, you know, look, Andy Cole was in that mix too, but, you know, I'm not one for heartbreak. And I remember just being just very confused when he went to Man United. You know, it was like, I was a bit too young to really understand what it all meant. But with Les Ferdinand, whether it was the power of his shots, his ability to hang in the air, That to me was something that I just couldn't fathom, like how he just felt like he was there for an extra second. And just again, the way he played so well with the other guy that's going to be in this strike partnership, just supreme quality. Lovely guy as well to boot, from everything I've come across. And I think, yeah, if you're looking for a centre forward that maybe doesn't get as much appreciation, maybe because of when he was around, in terms of
definitely
that's him, I think.
So I always see people say Andy Cole is the most underrated striker. But I see that take so much that I think that can't be the case. And I think it is Les Ferdinand. And I think he is a better all-round player. And I don't know if you've seen the, I think it's called Fever Pitch. Maybe because it, not the film. There was a, I don't know if you would have got it in America, but BBC did a sort of four or five part series on it. And it was kind of about the inception of the Premier League in the first few years. And Les
Ferdinand
quite heavily on it. And it was good, actually, because it kind of, for people that didn't know about him, it kind of gave them a bit of his story and how good he was. And, you know, not just about when he was at like Leicester and West Ham and stuff like that, but when he was an absolute monster at QPR and Newcastle. Yeah. And yeah, I think he's a really good player. When I was growing up, we had these like football, there would have been videos, like training certain things, and Les Ferdinand was like the guy for like headers and the
footcons
and stuff. He was like the guy that was like, oh, let's look at the professional and let's look at like the guy that does it best, and it was him doing it. And it's hard to believe. He's only about 5'9", apparently, but it doesn't play like it, does he?
No, not at all. I mean, yeah, the mention of football training videos has absolutely sparked something, because I always remember one day my dad took us to a charity shop and he found, I'm guessing, you know, Lillishaw, the sort of famed England school that like Joe Cole and that came through.
Yeah.
They must have produced some videos around that time. And he brought us that and kind of bought it for us and then brought us home and was like, right, watch this and you will get better. You'll just watch it. And I mean, we were daft idiots, so didn't really take it in properly. But yeah, I think you've nailed it there. He's someone that probably is deserving of more praise than he's had to date.
And just on Peter Beardsley as well. We had John Solarco and Pat Nevin on doing their sort of, I suppose, version of this, but for players they played with. And I think John Solarco said Beardsley was the best player he's ever played with. And that would have been very late on in Beardsley's career. And I mean, Nevin played with Dalglish, but he still found space for Beardsley, like, to be in his 11. So yeah, from just doing those two, kind of got a bit more about how much of a great player that he is. And he's probably one as well, underrated, isn't it, because of, I guess, he didn't do it all for England like some of the others did, but
yeah,
in his club career.
I think you know what it is as well. I think some of it is timing a little bit as well, because, you know, I like to try and see like Gascoigne on YouTube, and you realise that in actuality, people like Beardsley, people like Gascoigne, they had these long careers, but in reality, all we've ever seen is like snapshots of them, like Italia 90 with Gascoigne or that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think it's changing. I mean, I've stumbled across YouTube channels now that, crazy it sounds, will do like all touch compilations for Paul Gascoigne at Lazio and Rangers. And you do get to see more of them around. I will say, I think it works both ways, because obviously Ruud Gullit had a spell at Chelsea, like right at the end of his career.
Yeah.
And I watched like a highlight compilation of that, and I was like, oh, he's still an absolute player. Like, you know, it looks like he never makes a mistake. What a guy. And then just as like a follow-up video to that, it was someone, I don't know why, had uploaded a full game, Chelsea against Southampton at the Dell from that season. And I'm watching it. And look, you know, if he's ever listening to this, I'm sorry, Ruud, I don't mean to disrespect you in the slightest, but he made quite a few mistakes. He gave it away quite a lot. Like, there's a lot of just like bad touches or poor passes.
Yeah.
And you realise that actually sometimes when you can like curate a career like that, it can elevate slightly. I mean, look, Hullet, Gascoigne, Beardsley, all tremendous players. But yeah, that's amazing about John Solarco. They'll have been together at Bolton, I'm guessing?
No, I think it was Fulham.
Ah, okay. Okay.
I wasn't even there. I don't think either of them were there for that long either, but...
just passing.
Yeah.
Wow. Fair play. Well, that must have been a heck of a training session with Peter Beardsley in it. But yeah, that leads me on neatly to the final one. If you can't guess it, then I think we're in trouble.
Is it Oberfelly Martins?
Yeah, exactly. Pro Evolution Soccer legend Oberfelly Martins, who I did actually meet in the street once when he had signed, and I remember frantically getting some. I didn't know. Yeah, I couldn't afford the legal bill on that one.
But
I remember grabbing some paper out of my bag and just asking him to sign it, because you just didn't really see footballers that much. But yeah, no, to stop my digression, it is Alan Shearer. It has to be.
Yeah.
He. What can I even say about him? Just, you know, you look at Alan Shearer at Blackburn, you see this great athlete who bursts through, can run in behind, all this kind of stuff, and then he has these really unfortunate knee injuries and has to kind of reinvent himself as a forward, and just becomes this like powerful, can cross it, can shoot, can head. You know, at the minute, even just thinking about him, like, my mind floods with stuff, like the game against Chelsea where he kind of just bullied Marcel Desailly, just up against the back, like no real concern for who he was or what he was or anything like that. And just, yeah, a truly wonderful footballer and someone that I can watch now and still get the same feeling as when it happened the first time. And you know, you try and pick a favourite goal and it's really difficult. It really is, because there's the one against Everton, which I think everyone points to as just like a great example of how technically brilliant he was as a striker, which I agree with, a wonderful goal. One that I personally like, maybe that doesn't get as much airtime, which I think you will appreciate, was in the FA Cup semi-final against Tottenham. It was in extra time and it goes left. Silvio Maric cuts in, just lays it off to Shearer on the edge of the box, and with his right foot, he kind of strikes through it so it slices up into the top right corner. Puts us through to Wembley. And I have to give amazing credit to Clive Tilsey, because the commentary, you know, like when in a goal, it doesn't say anything, it just goes, oh, yes, that's the way to do it. And I'm just like, yeah, that's it. In that moment, you could have convinced me that Clive was a Newcastle fan as well, because I'm like, yeah, we're feeling the same thing here, me and you, Clive. And yeah, you know, talk about prized possessions. I was incredibly fortunate to get to meet him a few years ago, and he was just a diamond. Yeah, he was just an absolute. I think he's very aware of what he means to people from my part of the world.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think, and I was incredibly nervous, and you know, at first I didn't really want to bother him for a photograph, and then he was, oh, come on, let's get one, and just like a lovely bloke from start to finish. And funnily enough, that whole situation is probably one of the many things that convinced me to end up marrying my wife, because she is from New York, and it was the first time she had come to England to visit me. And so we met in London, and in the days building up, I said, look, like, I've got this chance to meet Alan Shearer, like a do, like, are you okay with that? And she was like, absolutely, just get yourself away, you know, go and sort yourself out, get an autograph and all that. And I thought, yeah, I think she might be the one. She hasn't kicked off. She hasn't said, you know, I didn't fly all this way just for you to go meet Alan Shearer. She was golden about it. But yeah, it's a wonderful footballer, and I don't think we'll see one like him, to be honest. I don't think we'll ever see another one. Not even in just in terms of the way he plays, but just a one club man like that. And I know he played for Blackburn and Southampton, but in terms of that dedicated period and that goals record, I don't know about you. You know, tell me what you think. I think if Harry Kane doesn't beat that goals record, it's going to stand for a good while yet, I think.
Yeah, I think it's got to be an English person that would break it, I think, because naturally, I think if someone from abroad comes over, even someone like Salah, like, realistically, yeah. you're not going to be here long enough to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know if Kane, I think Kane might do it, but it's really only because Shearer's had two massive injuries. Imagine he didn't have the injuries. Like, everyone talks about R9, Van Basten, and rightly so. But can you imagine if Shearer didn't have them injuries, how many goals he would have scored? That record yeah. definitely would never be beaten. Like, Harry Kane, I think if Shearer didn't have them injuries, Harry Kane would have to have another sort of 4 or 5 20-goal seasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm not sure that would ever be getting beaten. Yeah.
And some of his goals came before the Premier League as well. That's the other thing. It's,
yeah.
it's like,
yeah.
as great as that 260 number is, you know, the 260, like, that's Premier League goals only. Like, it's not total goals. Like, he's, yeah, a behemoth of a forward. Like, it just, yeah. I tell you what, if we had, like, him in Qatar, I think we'd win the whole thing, no questions asked.
Yeah, yeah, he could definitely do it now. I mean, he'd give any defender these days so much trouble. One goal I really appreciate for Shearer was against Chelsea in the first Abramovich year. I think it was not too different to the Everton goal, but not as good.
Yeah.
But basically, this was like a Super Sunday game. And then we had Tottenham at White Hart Lane next. And we only needed a draw because you guys beat Chelsea. So if you had lost to Chelsea, we wouldn't have been able to win the league at White Hart Lane.
Oh, okay. I'm almost convinced is the Marcel Desailly one I'm talking about. Where
yeah, I think it was, yeah. Because I think that was Desailly.
He sort of just...
season.
Yeah, he sort of just—he's just got his arm, like, he's pinned up against him, and he's just.
Yeah,
it might as well be a dummy. Like, yeah, no disrespect to Marcel Desailly.
Like, come out of the air. Yeah, I think he had to kind of, yeah, get through him, and in some ways you could say it's maybe harder, but I guess it didn't look necessarily as good a goal.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know. It's some of the power of his goals in terms of there's other ones as well, you know, for anyone that's listening that's not familiar with him, there's a goal at St James's against Aston Villa against Peter Schmeichel where it's kind of diagonal pass off to the back post and he just kind of passes it in like that. That's the thing, you know, we talk about what kind of goals strikers score. He really could score every kind. I don't think there was one that he struggled with. And as much as people want to point to the penalties and stuff like that, like, I think that would make a lot more sense, you know, when you talk about, like, an Andy Johnson at Palace, who probably did rely on penalties quite heavily for portions of his career. I don't really see that with Shearer. I just see a striker that found a way to score a lot of different types of goals.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what did he get, like, 60... penalties, maybe?
About that, maybe, yeah. 40 on the low end.
Oh, okay. So you're only talking three or four goals.
Yeah.
Like a season max. Maybe less. So, yeah, it's not going to... probably doesn't make a dent in a few of his Golden Boot winning seasons. I think he would have been so clear on some of them anyway. But,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'd love to see him play in this era, because I don't know, some of the defenders, some of the centre backs these days compared to what they was in the 90s and the 2000s, he'd have an absolute field day, I think.
Yeah, and then, I mean, you look at the rest of the team that we've got down here as well in terms of. You know, Robert whipping them in, Solano whipping them in, you know, Kabay finding them with passes, and then you got Big Les causing some problems up there. I would like to think this team is going out to score goals. It's not one that's trying to shut out a 1-0 win after the 70th minute, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose, speaking of scoring goals and entertaining and stuff, I didn't ask you to pick a manager, but have you got an idea of who you might want managing this side?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people will always go with Kevin Keegan, and I love Kevin Keegan just because he was not from the Northeast, but I think he understood the people of the Northeast very well. Yeah. There were things he said, and things like Alan Shearer is a great example. When we signed Shearer, we were away on tour in the, I think it was in Asia, and he was doing a press conference for something related to something else, and he basically said, like, yeah, look, we have signed him, but we're not going to unveil him, we're not going to do anything here, we're going to wait until we get home, we're going to do it in front of our people, it's their money, it's only right that they see him first. And you look at things like that and you think, yeah, that's, I'm a stickler personally for the little details, but then also managers that actually care, as obvious as that might sound. Like, and I think that's why if anyone is going to get ahead of Kevin Keegan to manage this team, for me, it's got to be someone that cares. And so Bobby Robson, you know, God rest his soul, what a man. Just like, I could speak for hours about Keegan and even longer about Sir Bobby in terms of just the class and the dignity of the man, first and foremost. Like, outside of football, like, I think it's very telling that there were no criticisms of him when he unfortunately passed away, because I think everyone found something to like in him. And look, if more of us were like that, we'd have a quieter world. It'd be a nicer place, probably. And I think you look at, you know, people like Craig Bellamy and the stories that they have about being able to calm him down without him even realizing that he's doing it, things like that. And had such an eye for a player. And you look at some of the players that, you know, played under him, Ronaldo and Romario and the teams at Barcelona. Look, I think he's just, in terms of exports of the Northeast, he is someone that, in a weird sort of way, I take quite a pride in almost. Because he went abroad. But, like, I don't think he changed who he was when he did. Like, I think it's very easy when you move away. I mean, I don't know if you saw that clip of Liam Payne after the Oscars. And his accent's, like, six different directions. And it's all, like, like, don't get me wrong, I've caught myself occasionally. Your accent when you go abroad does change a little bit. But I just think something I always found really endearing about Sir Bobby that maybe wasn't as talked about is when he was in Portugal and he would do these interviews and he would speak Portuguese, he would speak Portuguese with the clearest Northeast accent that I've ever heard in my life. And I just think little things like that, I'm just like, yeah, what a guy. And a great manager as well. You know, I would never want it to make it seem like he was just a great person. He was a very good football manager and came back to Newcastle and turned things around at a speed and with a quality that, again, you know, you only appreciate the older you get in terms of how good that team was and how close they ran the league, actually, at a time when Man United only looked like they get stronger every year. Your beloved Arsenal were again, a really dangerous and tough side to play against. And he did wonders for us. It didn't result in a trophy, which, unfortunately, is kind of the story of Newcastle. But, yeah, just what a guy. What a tremendous human being.
Yeah. When he came in, was it on a similar level to Shearer in terms of, like, the fanfare and all that? Because he was such a massive name at that point, being England manager, Barcelona, PSV and stuff, and being from the North East. Like, was it a similar sort of reaction for him coming in?
It's a good question. I'd say probably not as big, because I think, in general, I think transfers, I think, are just built to gain more attention because there's usually like a fee involved. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen the actual unveiling of Shearer. With the big brown ale bottle. Is that peak 90s. It's like all it's missing is like Chris Evans hosting it or something. But, like, I don't think it was as big, but I do, at the same time, I do remember we were coming through an airport once. And he was at PSV at the time. And my dad was like, that's Bobby Robson. He's coached England. It was like very, he made me aware of like how important he was. Because again, this is something that I think the modern generation benefits from. Not to sound like I'm 96 or something, but they get so much more exposure to football like across Europe than we ever did. The Champions League was like our only real gateway to see like a Batistuta or someone like that for the most part. So yeah, I think it was big in terms of, we were at a low ebb. I don't know if it quite had the like glitz of like a Shearer because of what that symbolized financially and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I remember people being absolutely delighted that he had come in because of his quality and turned things around almost instantly, or just felt like he flicked a few switches and the team just started winning again.
Yeah, I think he's one of them. You've got to respect him, got to love him, really. Yeah, top manager. And as well as Southgate's done, I still think the Bobby's the best that England have had in the last sort of 40, 50 years as a manager, for sure. Like, what he managed to do anyway in 86 and 90 and stuff. You know,
yeah.
I think with really stronger opposition too. So, yeah, that's a top one. How do you think Eddie Howe's getting on at the minute? And do you think he's a long-term Newcastle manager? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like the thing is, I think it's his job to lose at this point. Because, yeah, you probably say a little bit like Kevin Keegan in that regard of, I think he's come as an outsider and appreciated it for what it is. Because I think it's difficult because, as I'm sure you find with Arsenal, there are a lot of perceptions about your football club and what an Arsenal fan's like that just don't really tally, but have just become true because of what people have said or thought about you. Like, yeah. Things like, oh, you know, Arsenal are easy to rattle. You give them a kick. Like, yeah, you give most people a kick, they're not going to be too pleased about it. Like, it's just the way it works. Like,
yeah.
And I think there were certain perceptions about what a Newcastle fan was like or what our expectations were that kind of just didn't really tally up with what it was. Yeah, you know, when we were near the top, there was a belief that we could stay there. I think the key word is belief. It's the belief and the ambition. It's not an expectation. And I think for Eddie Howe, he's come in and just been able to read the room quite well. And where people in the past, without wishing to name specific managers, have probably used that expectation or used that stereotype as a crutch when things haven't gone well, I think Eddie Howe's come in and kind of embraced it and said, you know, I want to work hard. And deep down, I don't even think this is just true in Newcastle. I think it's true anywhere. If you work hard, I think most football fans appreciate you.
Yeah,
it's what we said before, you know, hard work. If you can't guarantee quality, guarantee hard work and you'll probably do all right. And I think that's what Eddie Howe has done. He's come in, he's worked incredibly hard and he's built a team that has been quite entertaining to watch. He's had some great results. And I think now he has earned the chance to actually shape the team in the direction he wants, because I don't think, and I don't blame him either, this team is 100% what he wants. I think he looked at it and thought, this is what I've kind of got to do to get us out of the mess that we're in. And look, you know, I was literally just watching a video probably an hour ago before we started recording of all of the pundits saying, oh, Eddie Howe's not that exciting and all this kind of stuff. And in a funny way, I didn't really see that from Newcastle fans. I personally was like, look, I don't know how this is going to go. It might go well, it might not. But in reality, I'm more than happy to give him at least the whole of next season, barring some catastrophic fall down. It's something where I think, yeah, he deserves the opportunity now to show us what he can do. And it's the first time in a long time I'm excited for the start of the season. It's the first time where I'm genuinely excited, which is a nice change for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'd ask you where you think you're going to finish this season, but I think for Newcastle specifically, you've kind of got to wait until the transfer window's opened a little bit and see what's happened, because this really is one where anything can happen, because the sort of players you're targeting are not them kind of free agents that are just looking for one big last payday. You know, someone like a Rudiger or something like that. It's actually people that are right age and seem to be the right profile. So, yeah. I did say it's good that Newcastle are back, but actually, as an Arsenal fan, I'm a bit worried. That top six is getting a bit crowded. I think I can't see you finishing below seventh. And that's quite a big shout, probably, but...
The thing I think we've got to probably figure out is how much of last season was adrenaline, you know? Like, how much of it was just... Because I personally...
Happened the year before, didn't it, a little bit?
Yeah, we've had some strong finishes the last couple of years, actually, since we've come up under Rafa. And even under Bruce, we seem to finish seasons quite strongly. That was what that Joe Willock run of form was, you know, where he got like 7-7. So, and I also think as well, something that I've not really seen mentioned much is, I don't think teams are going to treat us the same way next year as they did this year. I think it took a while for teams to actually see us as a bit of a threat in games. It was still like, oh, they are near the bottom, like we should be beating this lot.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we've been linked to, is it Ekitike or someone, the lad from Stade de Reims. We've been linked to a few others, Diaby at Leverkusen. You put them in that team, I think a lot of teams start to treat you very differently. And I'm sure you'll know this at being an Arsenal fan, that there are teams, probably my Newcastle team in years gone by, that pitch up and have no desire to try and get anything but a draw. Just don't want to even, the bus is in front of the goal and that's it. And so how he manages, Eddie Howe, to build a team that can break through that, I think will probably define how next season goes. But honestly, the idea that we are going into a season and we are genuinely looking at the top half of the table and not the bottom half is like such a brilliant feeling. I can't really put into words. Like, I hate relegation. I hate the threat of it. Like, watching that last few weeks for Leeds and Burnley fans, like, I said as much. I was like, being in a relegation fight is probably the worst feeling going, because it just chews your stomach. Watching it as a neutral is possibly some of the best entertainment football can offer. Like that and the Champions League semi-final is like right up there, I think, in terms of consistent entertainment.
Yeah, definitely. And it always seems to be a swing, like even on the last day or, you know, the one before. It's never really finished early, whereas sometimes you get league seasons where top and rock bottom and stuff are done, but you've always got them couple of teams fighting right to the end. But yeah, I don't think we're going to be seeing Newcastle in those sort of conversations any time in the near future. But that was some team, very, very attacking. So I think it is pretty good as well. You've got Bobby there to kind of calm it down a little bit, shall we say. But yeah, before I let you go, I've got two questions. So your favourite player ever?
Just Newcastle or ever?
We can open that up. Newcastle, and if you've got someone.
That's difficult. Newcastle, I'm going to go Shearer. The problem with best player ever is I have go through phases. I don't know if you're like this as well, where I go through phases where I'll just like binge on. Like at the minute, I'm just watching tons of Michael Carrick. Like I'm just like very fascinated with how good he actually was. So favourite player ever, probably the one. See, I was even watching a lot of Jack Wilshere just last night. Just like
he is one of my favourite ever players.
Yeah, see, it's like, you know, my wife and my dad and people like that will make fun of me. They're like, you will like watch any football. Like you're really not. You don't have to watch the top level. You'll watch anything that's about. And I find that stuff kind of interesting. So, favourite player ever. One that jumped into my head is probably David Beckham, actually, as well, because I thought, the difficulty is I like midfielders that are intelligent. So even someone like Paul Scholes or Michael Carrick. So because I can't give you a definitive one, I'll just keep it in the realm of Newcastle and say Alan Shearer.
Okay. And the best Newcastle kit ever? Because you've had some nice ones, I think, over the years.
Can I flip it on you first and ask what your favourite Arsenal kit is ever?
Okay. So it, maybe it's because of the success that it brought.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the JVC one.
Yeah.
And I know some people absolutely love the bruised banana one, but I'm not. I don't know about that one. I'm not so sure.
I get that. I always remember. So, goes back to kind of what I said before about, like, you know, you didn't get the most exposure when you were a kid. So, the first game of football I ever remember watching was Man United Tottenham at White Hart Lane. And one of the first teams I ever remember watching was Arsenal as well. And I remember I was in school, can't have been older than like 6, and I was drawing the Arsenal kit, and I wrote JVC on the front. And I tried to explain to my teacher, I was like, no, this is what is, like, this is the Arsenal shirt. And she said, but what's JVC? I'm like, it's what's on the Arsenal shirt. Like, I don't know. And she was very confused. But yeah, one for marketers there, I guess, the subliminal element does work. My favourite Newcastle, it's got to be the Entertainers kit, I think, hasn't it? I don't think you're going to get better than that. Look, as I get older, it's helpful that those are a bit baggier in terms of wearing them. You feel a bit better squeezing yourself into a large compared to the modern kits where you're questioning how many X's you're going to need on the front. But yeah, I think not even just how it looks and the memories associated with it, but I think the fact that the sponsor is Brown Ale.
Yeah.
What I've always appreciated about the Brown Ale logo is the blue star with the little kind of silhouette of Newcastle. Now, to be fair, that was on kits before the Entertainers one. That wasn't the first one to have the blue star on. But I just think, yeah, when I see that kit, when I think about the goals associated with it, it's just pure happiness. Like, you can't you can't think anything else, I think.
And is Brown Ale, is that really popular out there, or is that a bit of a myth?
That's a good question, actually. I think yes, it's popular, but I'll be honest, it's not the go-to when I go out with my mates from back home and stuff like that. I will say, when the takeover went through, as conflicted as I was about everything associated with it, I definitely had a Brown Ale to celebrate. Like a massive stereotype that I am. But yeah, we all did. I think we all raised a glass somewhere. But yeah, it's nice. If you get the chance, if you haven't had it and you get the chance, I would take it, because it's not too bad.
All right, I'll have to. I'll have to have a look. I'm not sure I've seen it in actually. Yeah, it's got to be in there somewhere. Yeah, I'll have a look out for it. But yeah, Christian, cheers for coming on and talking through your Newcastle 11. It's been good sort of listening to back when Newcastle were a real force, and it does look like it's going in that direction. So yeah, it's good time to be a Newcastle fan. But before we let you go, anything you sort of want to plug or sort of say what you're working on or anything?
Not especially. Just yeah, thanks for having me on. It's I don't get to do many of these days, but no, this was tremendous fun and filled with nostalgia. So yeah, thanks for having me on, mate. I appreciate it a lot.
No problem. It's been a pleasure. Cheers, Kristen. And remember, guys, to keep it.